His name is Teddy, and he's 19. He's only a seaman, and this is his first day. He was barely at Camp Nash for a week before they sent him here. And he is still not sure why they did, because all he does is move equipment and look out of windows. He is sorry. He is rambling. But it's only that he doesn't know what the CDC doctors are saying most of the time. And medicine is confusing. And he is very nervous. Lockhart, try to remember how a boy is built. Can only see his eyes above his surgical mask. The rest of his body, blurred by the plastic suit. Hair brown like mine. Skin golden but faded. Like it's missing the sun. Teddy asks me questions. Teddy asks me what day it is. He asks me my birthday. My last name. The price of milk. I don't answer. I want to, but the words won't line up on my tongue. Jack fell down and broke his crown, he says. Jill. Jill. Come on, you know this. Jill came tumbling, I say. But that's all. Can't. And oh God, I forgot. I forgot how it hurts. Like a shock. Like bile. Stinging in my throat, like a shiver in my bones. Shaking and screaming, and if I don't stop, I'll just break apart and... Eyes wet. Stomach heave. Quiet, Teddy says. Please be quiet. That hurts us both. Tells me it's okay. Tilts a cup of water to my lips. Drip. Drip. And swallow. Locks the door behind him when he goes. Alone. Awake. All of me here in my body. Nobody around. Just the whir of a fan somewhere beyond my curtain. Tug and tug, but the straps around my wrists have no give. I think I have been a problem all my life. Here I am where problems go. First Raxter. And now here. And I have always been heading here, haven't I? Haven't I? Too bright, and too bored. And something missing. Or perhaps, something too much there. It was my mother's idea, and my father just nodded and went to sit in another room. Silence all that summer, until they put me in a car headed for Raxter. Nobody there will know, I told myself. Nobody will know what you do when you're bored. What you do just because you can. Teddy comes back with the sun. Tells me they're figuring it out. Quiet for now, he says. And I don't mind. I remember the hurt. And he lays out a packet of forms. Unbuckles my wrists. And moves the IV stand, and helps me write the answers down. Buy it. Buy it, Windsor. 16. Almost 17. January 14th. No allergies. Elizabeth and Christopher Windsor. Beacon Hill. What street? West Cedar. House? Number 6. You're getting anxious, Teddy says. Don't get anxious. I almost forgot. I write. But you didn't. Wake up before I'm supposed to. IV still full. A haze I can't blink away. And when I close my eyes, I am back in the woods. That night. The night I came here. Cold. Damp. Irises. Crunching. Under. My boots and Welch holding me tight. For the best, she says. For your friends. Like there's a choice I made. But it wasn't. I didn't and pulled me from the infirmary. marched me down the stairs. No guards, no nothing. Hetty asleep somewhere, Hetty alone. She needs me, I said, and Welch said no. Said she needs you to do this. Through the gate into the trees. Sounds in the brush, animals moving their eyes like torches. Welch's breath warm on my ear, and then people waiting. They took me even though I fought, even though I ran. Dart in my thigh, and a fog in my brain, and Welch leaning over me. I'm sorry, she said. And I think the worst part is I think she meant it. Something blew out in the bigger room, and I notice, my eyes clear, world firm and real around me. Barely time to see it all. Barely time to check my IV and see it's empty before the curtains sliding back, a rustle of plastic pushing through. And then it's a person, a woman in a suit like Teddy's, standing at the foot of the bed, holding a patterned hospital gown. Hello, she says. She sounds like she's smiling. Time to change. She undoes every strap holding me down and helps me to my feet. My limbs are weak and shaking, so she undresses me, her heavy fingers working slowly at the buttons on my shirt and the laces on my boots. For a second, I'm shivering in my bra and underwear, and I see her staring at me, at my back where that extra ridge of bone erupts through my skin, and then the gown is slipping over my head. I can't even lift my arms to get them through the holes. She has to do that for me. Her suit is thick like Teddy's, rubbery and stiff. They must be afraid of me, of what I have. But it stops at her neck, and I can see the beat of her pulse. Count it. 1, 2. And it feels better that way. Does that feel all right? The woman asks as she straps me back in. Comfortable? I open my mouth, but she lays one gloved finger across my lips before I can get anything out. Let's stick with nodding for now. Teddy tells me we've had some trouble with talking. She pulls back the curtain a little more to show a sink tucked into the counter against the wall. It doesn't look quite like a hospital. There's something sad and ordinary about it, like the kitchen in a back room of a church, or the break room in an office building. The woman fills a plastic cup of water for me and holds it to my mouth until I take a sip. We'll get you something to write with, she says. In the meantime, it's probably best to let you rest. You've been through a lot. I keep drinking until the cup is empty. She dumps it in a trash basket by the foot of my bed and comes closer. I'm Dr. Peretta, she says, bending over my right arm. Should I call you by it? Or is there something else you like to go by? A nickname, maybe. I shake my head. By it is. All right. You might feel a pinch. I don't see exactly what she does. There are too many folds to her suit. But when she comes away, it's with a tube of blood. She holds it up to the light, squints, like she can tell what's happening inside, and then fetches a small red cooler from the foot of the bed and slots this vial of blood inside, next to another one. Potential racks, I think it's labeled, but she closes it before I can read the rest. One last thing before I forget. And then I'll leave you to sleep. She takes my hand in between hers, curls my fingers and bends my wrist so that I can feel the side of the bed frame. There's a button there, round and raised. This is your call button, in case the pain gets too bad or you need something. Do you feel it? I nod. She looks at me, and then she straightens back up, waits another second or two. Then, "Do you remember my name?" My lips peel apart.
Beretta.
I wanted to say it, to say something, to have my voice again. And I didn't think it would hurt that bad. Just one word couldn't hurt that bad. But it does, like something's trying to rip my spine out through my throat. "Well," says Peretta, she sounds out of breath, "we won't be doing that again." Chapter 8. Gone until I'm not. Flat on my back, the world moving around me as four suited figures wheel my gurney into a dark room. I test the restraints at my wrists, but they hold firm, nylon rubbing my skin raw. "Good morning," one of them says to me. I almost don't recognize her, but there, the eyes, and the curling brown ponytail. Peretta. High ceilings, no windows. An operating room, with something makeshift about it. The table in the middle is shrouded in paper, lit stark and hard. They line the gurney up alongside it, and begin to undo my restraints. I could fight, I know. But the door's shut and locked behind us. And I don't know, really, what I'd even be fighting for. I barely have a second once the buckles are undone, before they're gripping me tight and lifting. They swing me onto the table and stretch my arms out, strapping them back down. I wince, the ridge of bone that runs like a second spine, grinding uncomfortably against the table. One of the doctors wraps a blood pressure cuff around my left arm, and as it tightens, the other settles an oxygen tube under my nose and adjusts it. After that come sensors, stuck to my forehead and chest, and I watch as the screens start to show slices of me, to record the beat and wave of my heart. "It's all right," someone says, and it's Peretta, bending over me. She pushes my hair off my face. "You're here to help us figure out what's happening, and how to fix it." The other three doctors are stepping back slowly, until I can't see them anymore. It's just me and Peretta. "We've been working with some of your friends," she says, "and we think we're nearly at a point where we can make real progress here. But I need your help. Can you do that for me, Byatt?" "My friends? Have there been others here?" I open my mouth to ask, to say something, but Peretta claps her hand over my mouth. "Remember?" she says. "Stay quiet. This will be over before you know it." After a moment, she lets go, grabs a nearby tray and wheels it over. Silver on silver. Bouquet of scalpels, wrapped in plastic. I start to struggle, the sight of the blades sparking a gut-deep fear, something writhing in my stomach. It takes everything in me not to yell. But it's not the scalpels she reaches for. It's something else, lying small and innocuous next to a bottle of water. A round, yellow pill in its own clear sleeve. "This is all it is," she says, tipping the pill into her palm. "Nothing to worry about." Rax 009, I see, labeled clearly on the discarded sleeve, before Peretta takes hold of my jaw and pries it open. The pill is on my tongue then, dissolving, bitter, and slow. 009. The ninth version of that pill, maybe? Or the ninth girl strapped to this table. I swallow, gagging as the taste hits the back of my throat. Peretta watches me carefully before reaching for the bottle of water, the brand the same as we get back at Raxter. She undoes the cap and props my head up as she pours a little into my mouth. There's a clump of powder stuck on my tongue, and it takes a few tries to get it down. I was expecting something to happen right away. For the bones down my back to melt. For my voice to be back like it was. But 1 minute, and then another, and another. Peretta disappears, and I crane my neck to watch her join the other doctors leaning against the wall. They're waiting, just like I am. More time slipping by, and I drift off, come in and out. I'm so tired. My whole body aching, second spine tender and bruised. Maybe this whole thing isn't so bad if I'm getting a chance to rest. And then, a sparking. I know this feeling. Just before a flare-up, there's a moment. Hard to describe. Hard to pin down. But for me, it almost makes it worth it. The pain and the loss. All of it a fair price for this. This strength. This power. This eagerness to bare my teeth. I wait for it to fade, the way I'm used to. Wait for it to turn into blinding pain. Instead, it builds, ricocheting through my body, shredding my insides, and I feel my hands clench into fists, nails biting deep into my palms. The heart monitor starts going haywire, the room full of beeping and alarms.
What's going on? Get a readout from the monitor.
The doctors are rushing to gather data, their silhouettes blurring around me. I shut my eyes. This is my body. It will do what I ask it to. Calm down, I think. Hold it in. Only part of me doesn't want to. I can hear it, snarling and low, telling me to let go. Telling me this has always been inside me and that these doctors are trying to take it away. My back arches, eyes slamming open, thrashing against the straps pinning me, throwing my weight from side to side. Peretta, at the foot of my gurney, saying my name, but she's the one who did this to me. I scream. Blood dripping from my nose, agony lancing down my back. Peretta clamps her hands over my ears and falls back, and so I scream again, pull with everything I have against my restraints. Still the strength thrumming through my body. Still the gift the tox gave me. One of the restraints rips free. I scrabble at the other buckle and leap from the table, but the other doctors are there. They grab a hold of my arms, drag me back, and I kick, scratch tears down the front of their hazmat suits. Buy it! Peretta yells. Buy it! You need to calm down! And I want, suddenly, not to escape. Not to be free. I want to hurt her. I only make it a step before they stick the syringe into my neck. And the world goes dark.
Hetty. Chapter 9. I wake up with a headache, throbbing at my temples, sharp behind my blind eye. It leaves me clutching at the edge of my bunk, body braced for a flare-up. Since my first, they've all led with a pain like this, and followed with something worse. Last time it was wet webs of tissue, so thick in my throat I couldn't breathe, each fresh with blood, like they'd been ripped from the inside of my stomach. A headache like this could mean my next flare-up is coming. Or I know Byatt would say I could just have a headache. Above me, Reese's bunk creaks, and I remember everything from last night, all at once. Welch's voice, and the plans she made with a man on the walkie. The needle and thread, now tucked safely into my pocket. Byatt is somewhere in this house, and if I can't find her today, I'll find her tonight, past the fence, after midnight in the last of the dark. Reese and I will follow Welch to Reese's house, and Byatt will be there, and she'll be alive.
This lying in silence thing is fun, Reese says suddenly from above me. But can we go eat?
On the days without a supply delivery, meals are quiet, almost orderly. Anything good goes fast in that first rush after boat shift. All that's left is what nobody really wanted. Most of the girls wait in the main hall, but there's one from every small constellation of us that heads down the southern corridor to the kitchen, where Welch doles out the food and bottled water, ready to carry something back to her friends. This has been my job since the start. Byatt said people would feel the worst for me and let me have the best of what was there. They're scared of Reese, and that works for boat shift day. But the name of this game is pity, and I'm how we win. I leave Reese in the main hall and follow Kat down the south wing corridor. At the corner where the hallway hooks to the left, there's headmistress's office, one of the last places left we're still not supposed to go. I've only been there twice before, once on my first day at Raxter, and then again a semester later when I got reprimanded for talking during assembly. Maybe that's where they're keeping Byatt, I think. I have my hand on the latch before I realize I'm doing this in plain daylight, and Kat is waiting for me. I hurry to catch up with her. She gives me a smile, doesn't ask how I am or what the hell I was doing, and I'm grateful for that. After we put in an appearance at breakfast, I'll circle out around the house, peer through the windows of headmistress's office, and then keep searching if I don't find what I'm looking for. Together, Kat and I turn the corner and continue on to where the kitchen opens, with its skylights and checkerboard tile. The last time I was here, Byatt was on the floor, coming apart. The last time I was here, the whole world ended. Enough, I think. I'm doing what I can. Soon I'll have her back. A handful of other girls are already there, waiting for Welch to come in and unlock the pantry where we keep the food. I'm dreading having to look her in the eye, but there's no way she knows what I overheard last night. "Hey," says Emmy, barely up to my shoulder, her sleek hair still baby fine. After her first flare-up the other day, she was bouncing off the walls, excited to be like the rest of us, even if her flare-up left her coughing up teeth from somewhere deep inside. But today she's got on an affected solemnity. Of course she does. She's here for Landry, probably bursting with pride at representing the girl at the top of what's left of Raxter's social ladder. "I just wanted to say," Emmy continues, "I hope you're okay after what happened with Byatt." "Thanks," I say, and I hope that's it. But she keeps talking. "She's in our prayers." Emmy says it just the way Landry would, the same polished tone and rounded corners. "I'm sure she appreciates it," I say, rolling my eye. None of this is helping my headache, now dulled to a constant hum of pain. I'm used to it, but that doesn't mean I wouldn't rather have quiet than Emmy playing at being Landry. Footsteps pull our attention to the door. And finally, there's Welch, hastening into the kitchen, already fussing with the ring of keys on her belt. Where did she come from? Was she with Byatt? She doesn't look any different than she did yesterday. Doesn't look like she's hiding something. But after the pier, I know she's better at that than I expected.
"Sorry,"
she says as we crowd around her. There's a crust at the corner of her mouth, something yellowing. The smell's sour. Probably from one of those sores she and headmistress get.
"Bit of an issue. All right, who's first today?"
Passing out food used to be oldest first, the way it is at every other school, the way it was before. And then we realized the oldest would always be the oldest. None of us could leave. Now we rotate through, year by year, day by day. And it's youngest first today, which is why Landry's sent Emmy. She picks it just right, so she always eats first. Kat and I are near the middle, with Julia and a few girls from Carson's year behind us. It comes to my turn, and I duck under the lintel into the pantry and step aside to make room for Kat as she joins me. She seems okay today, her skin mostly healed. For the first season, we thought maybe that meant she was better. But the blisters keep coming back, bigger and deeper each time, a flash of bone visible at the bottom of them. The pantry is built off the back of the kitchen. Boat shift carry everything that isn't taken immediately, back here after each trip, unpack and unload it into the trash cans for storage. Every day, Welch drags one to the middle of the narrow room for us to root through. She counts what we take and writes it down. Cap brushes some cobwebs off her jacket and sighs, looking at sugar cubes spilled on the floor from where Emmy probably snuck some out with her.
We'll get ants.
We've got worse. I lean over the trash can, root through to the bottom where some girls try to bury things for themselves. There's a pack of jerky, just what we need, but I hesitate. I watch the rest of Boat Shift throw away enough food for all of us. I shouldn't take anything. I don't deserve it. But it's not just me I'm here for. It's Reese, too. And we both need to eat if we're going to make it to the Harker house tonight. I'll take the jerky and that thing of honey mustard nobody wants. Kat grabs a box of Melba toast and a packet of rice. She waits a moment before sneaking a mini box of raisins into her pocket.
It's Lindsay's birthday,
she says quietly.
Please don't tell.
I check over my shoulder to where Welch is leaning against the doorway, fiddling with the keys. She doesn't seem to have heard. Sure, I say. It's the least I can do after the pier. I show my pickings to Welch as I leave the pantry, do my best to keep my hand steady. How can she just stand there like nothing's wrong? Like she's not keeping my best friend locked up somewhere. I put on a smile, try to keep from wondering what's happening to Byatt while I stand here in the kitchen, flecks of her blood still dotting the floor.
All right,
Welch says absently.
You're fine.
I bite back the urge to rip the answers out of her. Hurry out of the kitchen, back to the main hall, where I'm startled to find Reese sitting with Carson. She's staring at her boots, and Carson is watching helplessly with that look I recognize. The look of someone beaten almost into submission by Reese's impassive silence. Hi, I say as I approach. Carson, this is a nice surprise.
Surprise is the right word, Reese says.
I frown at her. It isn't fair to snipe at Carson, who never knows it's happening, and she shrugs.
Morning,
comes Julia's voice from behind me.
Oh, good. Another one,
Reese says. But she sounds a bit gentler, looks almost rueful as she smiles at me. I sit down next to her, try to keep from raising my eyebrows as Julia takes a seat opposite me. We keep mostly to our own circles. But now that I'm Boat Shift, are Julia and Carson part of mine? Or are they here to make sure I'm keeping all the right secrets from Reese? It's a stifling quiet as we eat. I have nothing to say. And I know Reese certainly doesn't. And every minute we spend here is one I'm not looking for by it. Carson sits up straighter, opens her mouth to start a new conversation, and Reese levels her with a look.
We don't always have to be talking, you know.
Sorry, I say, giving Reese a sidelong glare. She has the decency to look a little guilty.
We're just tired.
No problem,
says Julia. If anything, she seems relieved to not have to make any more conversation. There's a fresh bruise peeking out from under the hem of her shirt, and she looks exhausted, like it's sucking the life from her as it grows. I watch as she spits out a mouthful of blood and leaves it there on the floor, not bothering to wipe it up. I can't finish my half of the jerky. Just the smell of it's making me sick. And if I pay attention, if I think about it too hard, I can feel a tingle starting behind my blind eye, breaking through the low haze of pain. Reese doesn't say anything, just takes the jerky from me and stuffs it into her pocket for later. She looks like her dad in this light, like the way he looked before, the same strong chin, the same eyes, all washed over with gold. I wonder what she thinks of when she looks at me. Not my parents. I never kept a photo of them pinned to my wall like some of the other girls did. I don't think of them much, my parents. I know I should. I did right after the talks, for the first month or two. I lined up for my radio call and we had short, stilted conversations. But then they cut off our access, and things got worse. And then it didn't matter anymore. Because if I see my parents again, they will want to hear how I miss them, how it was the worst thing that ever happened. And I'll be lying, if I can say it at all. Part of me really thought it would be that simple. A locked door, somewhere deep in the house, and buy it on the other side of it. Part of me really was an idiot. After breakfast, Reese followed me outside, and she kept watch as I peered through the window into headmistress's office. Nothing. Just the bulk of her old desk and a stack of cardboard boxes in the corner. Byatt's not there, I told Reese, and I told her the same thing as I checked every classroom and every office, every storage closet, every bathroom. The whole house unlocked like it was waiting for me, like it had something to prove. Eventually, I couldn't stand it anymore, couldn't think past the throbbing in my head, couldn't feel anything but the guilt of failing Byatt like this. And Reese took my hand, like she did last night, and she led me back outside. The air bracing and quick, waking the blood in my skin and thinning the pain in my head until it was barely there anymore.
"There's still tonight," she said quietly. "It's not over yet."
Now we're on the north side of the house, wandering aimlessly toward the point. Off to the left, the cliff tapering to nothing on our side of the grounds, and up ahead, a tetherball pole and a rusted swing set, both listing to one side, the dead grass around them covered in frost. I can feel the cold pricking in my lungs, points like knives, and my nose has gone numb. But I don't mind. Out here, I can breathe. Out here, I feel awake. The grounds are so open, nothing like the clustered press of the woods, and I'm thinking about that when I say, "We should get a gun." So suddenly that Reese nearly trips.
"What for?"
My body remembers the shake and the fear as I ran for my life that first time I was out beyond the fence. "Trust me, we want one."
"Sure," Reese says, frowning. "But it's not like we can steal one from the supply closet without Welch noticing."
A set of girls rambles by, on their way to wash their hair or steal some blankets or just be bored someplace new. And we give them a nod, a tight smile. Two are from the year below us, and the others are Sarah and Lauren from ours. I like Lauren, but Sarah's the girl who stole my last clean uniform skirt and got me a dress code violation my third week here. I can't stand the way she brags about her flare-up either. One heart, two heartbeats. Fantastic. She thinks it means she'll live longer. I think it just means she's that much more fucked.
"Hey, Hetty," Lauren says, slowing down. "Do you know if we're having target practice today?"
Welch would have said so at breakfast, and part of me wants to remind them of that. But I'm boat shift now. I'm the girl they come to with questions.
"Not today," I say. "Have a good one."
"Have a good one?"
Reese repeats under her breath. And I know if I look at her, I'll see her holding back a smile. Lauren looks a little disappointed, but she shrugs.
"Thanks. See you, Hetty."
"Look at you,"
Reese says once they're gone.
"You're like a politician or a mall greeter."
It's the way she teased me when Byatt was here. The same words, the same amused expression, but it's softer somehow. Or at least I don't mind it. I'm about to suggest we go back inside. Maybe keep an eye on the storage closet and hope Welch leaves it unattended during the day, when Reese tugs on my sleeve. She nods over my shoulder to where the barn is standing, empty and dark.
"Target practice," she says. "There's a gun we can take."
"How?" But she's already walking, leaving a trail of footprints through the frost. The barn's empty this time of day. Just vacant stalls and dust drifting, and the sliding doors open to the sea, chilled wind whipping through. I follow Reese to the back, behind the bales of hay stacked to make a target, to a long locked chest meant for saddles and stirrups. Now it's where Welch keeps the shotgun we use for our lessons.
"Here,"
Reese says, crouching in front of the chest. It's only got one padlock, the kind with a dial and a combination, and it looks rusted, like it might be easy to break. Welch would notice if we smashed it. But I'm about to say that some things are worth the risk when Reese starts turning the dial, spinning to a set of three numbers, 3-17-03, her birthday. The lock clicks open, and she looks up at me with a grin.
My dad set the combo, she says. I figured Welch wouldn't have changed it.
Reese lifts the lid and pulls the shotgun out from a pile of old tack, fishing for any loose ammo.
Now what?
We should hide it somewhere, I say, still surprised at our luck, as she slips a pair of stray shells into her pocket, the metal clinging to her skin in the cold. We'll only have two shots between us. Near the fence, maybe, so it's easy to grab on the way out. There's a copse of spruce trees off to the left of the gate, where some of the older girls used to bring their mainland boyfriends on visitor days. My face burns at the thought of going there with Reese. But we should be able to hide the gun there safely until tonight.
All right,
Reese says, and holds the shotgun out to me. I take it, unsure, only for her to turn around and shrug off her jacket. I'd be shivering if I were her, but all she's got are a few goosebumps down her arms.
Stick it in my waistband, and we'll run it up my back.
It'll work, but I can't help a burst of nervous laughter. She looks over her shoulder at me.
What? You have a better way?
Maybe it's her willingness to do this with me, to risk her life by it's because I asked her to. Maybe it's the line of her jaw, or the lure of her hair. But she's given me something, and I owe her something back. Hey, I say. You want to learn to shoot? I'm expecting her to snap at me. Instead, she sounds carefully bland when she says,
I know how.
I mean on your other side. A heartbeat of silence, her expression curdling to something doubtful. But it's not a no, so I try again.
I shoot righty. I could teach you.
Okay, she says, nervous, determined, just like me. I hand the shotgun back to her and lead her to the front of the barn, point her toward the patch of floor where the sawdust is ground. Reese takes her spot, drawing her jacket around her again, and I come up next to her.
Show me how you normally stand, she bristles.
A week ago, I'd have said it's because she hates to be told what to do, and she does. But I think she hates, too, to be seen as anything but strong.
Just show me, I say gently.
Reluctantly, she snugs the butt of the shotgun in against her left shoulder, barrel cradled in her right hand. She starts trying to hook the fingers on her silver hand around the trigger, but her fingers are too fine at the point, and they won't catch and pull.
See?
She says.
Right, I say, but that's okay. Now switch your position. Put your left foot forward and angle your hips.
They teach us to shoot in what Welch calls a bladed stance, with the support shoulder to the target and the trigger shoulder to the back. She says it's to make sure we hit right the first time, just in case the bullets stop coming on the boat and we have to make them count. Reese adjusts. Sets up with the shotgun lifted in her silver hand and her other hand waiting near the trigger. She's holding her shoulders the right way. But you can tell it's not how she likes it by the way her hips are still square.
You gotta commit, I say. Come on.
I can't really see this way.
I laugh. If I can see with one eye, you can see with two. She's fussing, trying to get the gun to sit right, but she won't be able to if she's standing like that. I come up close behind her, reach out, my hand hovering over her hip.
Can I?
She turns her head, baring the delicate skin along the nape of her neck, and my breath catches. A moment ago, it was nothing. This was nothing, just me and her the way we've been 100 times before. But it's not the same. By it gone, nobody between us.
Yeah, she says quietly. You can.
I rest one hand on her hip, the other sliding to her waist. She's warm through her jacket, alive and here with me. And if I couldn't feel it myself, I wouldn't believe it. But she's trembling. Reese, stoic and sharp and steel, shaking under my touch.
This way,
I say, turning her parallel to me. Her body learning the shape of mine, and I swallow hard. Keep your form, though. She lifts the shotgun again, and together we guide it into place, my touch keeping her hips bladed, my head ducked close to hers. Her lashes are dark against her skin as she shuts one eye to focus her aim.
There, I say unsteadily.
Perfect. We hold there, her frame inside of mine, and then she relaxes. Just barely, and not all at once, but it brings her back flush against my chest, my heart hammering, beat after shaking beat roaring in my ears. I've never been this close to her before, never seen the scar on the side of her nose, or the spot behind her ear where her hair sweeps away. It looks soft, tissue thin. And I don't mean to. Don't realize I'm moving, but I reach up and brush my fingertip over the vein that's just showing, barely blue. Her head whips around. I snatch my hand away. Mouth open, panic rising. I can't believe I've ruined it. Pushed too far and got too close, right when we were just starting to figure out how to be friends. Sorry, I choke out. Anything to get us back somewhere safe. I shouldn't have. She's just staring at me, breathing shallow and quick, the cold catching in clouds around her, shotgun dangling from her silver fingers.
What was that?
She says at last. I managed 3 years without giving it a name. But there she is. Reese, with her starlit hair and her wildfire heart. And I knew what to call this last night in her room. Her face beautiful and strange in the dark. I knew the day I met her, when she looked at me like I was something she didn't understand. I've known every minute in between.
Nothing, I say firmly.
Nothing. Nothing at all. I can close this door. I've had plenty of practice.
You don't have to worry about it.
No, Hetty. You have to tell me what that was. She sets the shotgun on the makeshift table, never taking her eyes off mine.
You have to, because I feel like I'm losing my fucking mind.
What do you mean? I say, keeping my voice as light as I can. I can do this. I can pretend, explain everything away. She's not falling for it.
I mean, you've been different with me,
she says. And I could swear she's blushing, but there's the stubborn push of her jaw, the fierce resolve that I know so well.
I mean, you've been looking at me like you finally noticed I'm here.
Like I finally noticed her? God, she has no idea. She really has no idea.
That's not
so,
she presses, ignoring me. I need you to tell me what that was just now.
A step closer. The cool shine of her braid washing over my skin.
I need to know if you're where I am.
My breath catches. She can't mean it, can she? I'm not used to this, to the tight bloom of my heart. It's been too long since I hoped for anything. And where is that?
Here, she says.
She reaches out, tangles our fingers together. Watching me the whole time, and she sounds so sure, so confident. But I can feel her shaking, just like I am. Like she spent as long wanting this as I have, and maybe she has. Every time she cut me down, every time I couldn't reach her. All because she wanted me, and she thought I'd never want her back. And if there's anything Reese does well, it's self-defense. But I can see through it now. And I know what we've done for each other, the concessions we've made, the slights we've swallowed, neither of us able to let go, no matter how much the holding on hurts. Yeah, I say. Yeah, I'm here too. For a moment, we don't move. And all I can hear is my heart marking time. Until Reese lets out a shaky breath. And then we're both laughing, leaning into each other, practically giddy with relief.
Okay. Good,
she says, her silver fingers careful as she traces the line of my jaw, So soft, I barely feel it. But I do, I do. And it lights me up like a match to paper. Our laughter falls away as the curve of her body fits to mine. She's still smiling when she kisses me. So am I. Chapter 10. Evening, and we're back up in our room. After leaving the barn, we snuck the shotgun out to the spruce copse by the fence, buried it there under a layer of rotting leaves. Reese next to me like always. Nothing different between us but the look in her eyes and the heat in my veins. Now she's sprawled on my bunk, watching me as I pace from one end of the room to the other. Every inch the sun sets is another notch of dread, a spring coiling in my gut. Closer and closer, the gate swinging open and Welch taking by it out into the woods. Out in the hallway, the other girls are drifting upstairs, back to their rooms in time for bed check. We stayed in the spruce copse clear through dinner, neither of us speaking, the iron bars of the fence looming larger and larger. I'm not hungry. Just thinking of food still makes me sick with guilt. But Reese's stomach picks that moment to grumble so loudly I can hear it from across the room. I stop pacing and watch as Reese sits up, takes the leftover jerky from breakfast out of her pocket, and crams most of it into her mouth. There should be more food here for us, I think, trying not to flinch, and there would be if I hadn't helped Welch on the pier. When she sees me watching, Reese swallows thickly and holds out what's left, barely a bite.
Sorry, she says. Did you want some?
I let out a wheezing laugh. This is ridiculous. Welch took my best friend from me, and here I am still keeping her secret. There's something I need to tell you, I say. And then I describe it as simply as I can. The bags, overflowing with food and its strange packaging, and the way Welch rested her hand so casually on her gun as she asked whether she'd made the right choice. Reese's mouth goes slack as I talk, dark eyes looking up at me from the bed, wide and incredulous.
You're serious, she says when I finish.
I nod. I haven't told her about the chocolate, but I can't see what good it would do, and some part of me wants to keep it for myself. Yeah, I say, and we just tossed it over. She doesn't say anything, just stares out the window, fists clenched, and I feel a gnawing in my gut. I can't have ruined things with us. Not already. Not before it's barely even started. Are you angry? She scoffs.
Of course I'm angry.
But I mean with me. She looks at me then, and tentatively hooks her fingers through one of my belt loops. How could I have missed it? The warmth in her eyes, just mine and nobody else's.
You didn't have much of a choice, did you?
It shouldn't, but it makes me feel better. Outside, I can hear Julia making her way down the hallway, stopping at each room for bed check. Reese and I exchange glances, and by the time Julia pokes her head inside our room, we're side by side on my bunk, right where we should be, two girls following the rules.
Three,
Julia says, and then she coughs delicately.
Sorry, two.
I stare at the floor after she goes, let my world narrow down to the slivers of dark between each floorboard. Welch will go out to the Harker house in a few hours, and so will we, picking our way through the woods, breaking the quarantine, fighting for our lives and Byatt's too. I can do this for her. I have to. Reese's cold, scaled fingers close around my wrist, the dark deepening around us. And when I turn to her, the aura of her hair is skimming over our skin, the pattern of her braid playing on the ceiling.
You should get some rest,
she says so gently I barely recognize her.
You'll need it out there.
I can't. Out the window, the moon is rising, and I only have the memory of how it lit the sky last night to mark the hours. I choke back the worry throttling me. What if we miss it?
I'll stay up.
The mattress shifts as she moves, and she drapes her jacket over my shoulders.
Go on.
At least if I'm asleep, I can't worry over what we're about to do. I let her urge me back toward the wall and stretch out on my side, leaving half the bed open for her. They're narrow, the Raxter bunks, built only for one, but I've shared one with Byatt since the first day of the talks. I'm used to it. Or I thought I was. Reese lies down next to me, her shoulder pressed to my chest. And it's nothing like that. Nothing like Byatt, whose body felt almost like my own. I can even feel the slightest spot where I'm touching Reese, can hear every breath she takes like it's the only sound in the world.
Okay,
she says. Yeah. I settle in, tuck my face against her neck, close my eye, hope I dream about Reese, about this afternoon in the barn. Instead, it's Byatt waiting for me, and I take her by the hand, lead her into the woods. There's no light, but somehow I can see as I stitch her into her shroud.
Byatt. Chapter 11. I told the story when I was 10 years old. It was just after summer break. My best friend was a girl named Tracy, whose clothes were always freshly ironed. And when Tracy got back from summer camp, she told me she'd met a new friend at camp. I didn't go to camp. I didn't meet a new friend. So I told Tracy something else. I told her I'd met a girl named Erin. Erin, who rode horses and swam all year round. She goes to a different school, I said. And she lives on my street, just a few houses down. And I wrote letters and told Tracy they were from Erin. And I had my picture taken with my horrible cousin, and I showed Tracy, told her it was Erin. And then one day I told her Erin wasn't at home anymore. I told her Erin's mother had said Erin was sick. And the day after that, I dressed in black, and I told Tracy that Erin was dead. Tracy cried. And she cried to her mother, and she cried to our teacher, who took me to the counselor's office and asked what had happened. And I told the whole story over again. Because I like to see what I can do. I blink, and my mother is at the window. There is a window. And my mother is there in blue like morning.
I thought we were past this, she says.
We were, and sometimes we still are. But there is a gnawing in my heart I cannot get out. The window shuts and disappears. And my mother gets taller and taller.
We're very disappointed,
she says, her head brushing the ceiling.
Disappointed, disappointed, disappointed.
Usually it was an accident, a lie I never set out to tell, a trick I never meant to play. I'd open my mouth, and something strange would come out, new and not mine, like there was someone else inside. I'm sorry, I'd tell my parents, whenever something I'd made came crashing down. I never wanted to hurt anyone. And sometimes I meant it. But sometimes I didn't. Anger, depthless and black. And I couldn't cut it out of me. Growing and growing until it was all I had room for. Go to Raxter, my mother said. Start again. And I tried. But we all have things we're good at. I don't miss talking. I thought I would. But it's so easy this way. The smallest word written down, and they'll build a version of me in their head. Sounding just the right way. Meaning just the right thing. Half my work done for me. When Peretta comes back, I see her shape through the curtain around my bed. I see her stop in the doorway, and I see her hesitate. Like she's remembering what I did. But then she's pulling back the curtain, and it's the same patched-up blue suit, the same faintly patterned mask, I wonder if they have any spares. Or if the other doctors had to stitch up the tears I scratched in theirs. Good morning, she says. My hands are strapped down. Can't reach for the whiteboard Peretta props against the bed. Can't do anything but give her a thumbs up, and I certainly won't be doing that. Do you know what a resonant frequency is? I raise my eyebrows. What a way to start the day. It's the frequency at which a particular object vibrates, Peretta explains. She sounds uncomfortable, like she's not used to putting anything so simply. When you match an object's resonant frequency, it can break. Like a glass, if you sing the right note. I clench my fists, wishing she'd let me use my whiteboard. I don't understand why she's telling me this. Most everything has one. She looks at me for a long moment. Even bone, but... I swallow hard. Remember the pain shattering through me. Shaking me apart. Me, and Peretta, and anybody else who heard me scream. There's nothing, Peretta says softly, that ever hits that frequency hard enough to make it hurt. Nothing but you and your voice. She reaches out and rests one gloved finger against my throat. What is it doing to you, sweetheart? I don't know, I want to say. You tell me. Instead, she steps back, the sadness sweeping out of her eyes as I hear her clear her throat. I'd like to show you something, she says, waiting briefly for an answer I can't give. But I think you can understand why I'll need your word that we won't have a repeat of the other day. I nod, because what else is there to do? And she bends over me to unbuckle my wrists. This close, she smells like sweat, like salt. I can see patches of dry skin at her hairline, a mole at the corner of her eye. I'm not strong enough yet to stand on my own, so Peretta has to help me into a wheelchair. Shivering out from under the blankets, legs bruised, toenails broken. Our bodies never seemed odd at Raxter. But here, I pull down the hem of my hospital gown, sit up straight to hide the second curve of my spine. She tucks the whiteboard in alongside me, folds my fingers around the marker, and then pushes me out of the ward. I try to hang on to everything, every turn we take. The small lobby we pass through, pale squares on the wall where something must have hung, and the hallway Peretta wheels me down, shabby carpet and stale air. But they slip in and out of my head, and I'm not as here as I thought I was. I think I might throw up, fold over, press my hands to my forehead, and I feel the brush of Peretta's suit against my shoulder. But it's barely anything. I shut my eyes, try to disappear. When I open them again, I'm somewhere else. At first, I don't know what I'm looking at. And then I blink and it separates out. Floor from ceiling. Stacks of boxes. Carts of folding chairs. And everything covered in thick plastic tarps. The floor is the same peeling linoleum as everywhere else, but carved into the walls are two deep alcoves, empty, but lit like something used to be displayed inside. I reach for the whiteboard, hold it up in front of Peretta to get her attention before I write. What is this? Where are we? Some of it's storage, Peretta says, which doesn't really answer my question. But I think it's all I'll get. She wheels me down a narrow path between two shelving units, each draped over with clear plastic so thick it looks cloudy. Here, another part of the room. This one, almost like a lab. Two tables set up with equipment I don't recognize. On one table, I think I spot the remains of a Raxter Blue. Shell broken up in bits, but we turn away.